unión, compare to neon. Life is no thrill, it's worse than neon. So draw the right conclusion, let them be still.
Welcome to episode number 86 of the Exploring Antinatalism podcast, a podcast showcasing the wide range of perspectives and ideas throughout antinatalism as it exists today, through interviews with antinatalists and non-antinatalist thinkers and creators of all kinds. Now running 5 years strong, I'm your host, Amanda Sukenik, and today I'm speaking with Professor of Philosophy at Warren Wilson College, Philosophical Advisor on the hit NBC sitcom The Good Place, and author of many books, including the upcoming book, Should We Go Extinct? A Philosophical Dilemma for Our Unbearable Times, Todd May. Welcome, Todd, to the Exploring Antinatalism podcast. It's an honor to have you with me on the show today.
Thanks, Amanda. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. Todd, you have certainly been involved in some really amazing things, namely as philosophical advisor on the hit NBC TV show, The Good Place, which I hate to admit I knew next to nothing about until preparing for this interview. What a fool I was, and what a fantastic show. I haven't got to see like all of it yet, but I love it. It's absolutely brilliant. And in addition to this, you are a professor of philosophy and author of many books, including the upcoming book to be released August 6th, if I'm not mistaken, called Should We Go Extinct? A Philosophical Dilemma for Our Unbearable Times, which will be a big part of our conversation today, I do believe. But to start us off, I was wondering if you wouldn't mind simply telling us, who is Todd May?
Yeah, so I taught at Clemson for 30 years. I'm actually now at Warren Wilson College, a small college outside Asheville. I retired and moved there. I was involved in a number of social movements, both during my time at Clemson and previous to my time at Clemson. Was the faculty advisor for the LGBTQ plus group for this first 7 or 8 years of its existence. But mostly what's relevant here is I do philosophy.
Todd, if I may ask, why are you or are you not an antinatalist?
Well, I'm not an antinatalist. I'm neither an antinatalist nor a natalist. In the book, what I try to do is argue that it's not clear that we ought to extend our species, and I give some reasons that our species contributes something to the world that isn't contributed by other species, or at least not to the extent that we have it. But then I talk about a lot of what we do to exploit and destroy parts of the world, and then end with the idea that there are things we can do to make our existence either more justifiable or more nearly justifiable.
I'm curious what you have to say about this. Antinatalism only just very recently became an official word in the Cambridge Dictionary, making it the first time that it's ever been included in an English dictionary. Before that, most just went along with whatever Wikipedia was happening to say about it that day, changed all the time. It was in two French dictionaries and one Portuguese one. Cambridge now defines antinatalism as the belief that it is morally wrong to have children, or that people should be encouraged not to have children. Some find that to be a perfectly satisfactory definition, others do not. Just in your opinion, how do you think antinatalism should be defined?
Yeah, what I like about that definition is that it covers two grounds, right? There's the moral ground, and then the non-moral ground, right? So there some antinatalists believe that the reason that we shouldn't have offspring or shouldn't continue the species is that it's damaging, and damaging, so damaging that it's better not to continue than to continue. But, you know, a lot of young people are wondering whether to have kids, and they're wondering about whether to have kids. It has a lot to do with the lives of their kids. Will their kids' lives be sufficiently good or sufficiently worthwhile or sufficiently meaningful, particularly given the climate crisis? So the question is, would it be okay for them, the kids, to be born? Now, Amanda, you can think about this as a moral issue. Would they be doing something wrong for the kids? But you can think about it also as a broader life issue. Right? Are the lives that might continue under the increasing climate disaster that we're facing going to be good enough that it's okay to bring kids into the world?
Also, the second part of that definition sort of hints at the idea of antinatalism being a social movement. And I'm curious about what you think of that too, because antinatalist activism, as it were, is very, very young, and it's incredibly controversial, even amongst antinatalists. Some are very for it, some are very against it. Do you have any thoughts about?
It depends a bit on how you're thinking about the consequences. So let's assume for a minute, I'm not assuming this in my book, but let's assume for a minute that the harm that we bring to other species on the planet is so great, right, through deforestation, factory farming, disposal of plastic, scientific experimentation, land use, and things like that. Let's suppose that we cause so much harm that in fact, the good that we bring is outweighed, right? That would be a moral reason to have a movement that's antinatalist. But if we look at the other direction about having kids, this seems to me largely a much more personal decision, right? I don't think one can decide for another whether the lives of the kids who might be born are going to be worthwhile or not. I think that's got to be a decision that's more local with the parents or at least with the parents and a small community. So really in thinking about whether a movement is justified, the question is what are the stakes? What would be the goal of the movement and why would it have that goal?
Excellent answer. Let's revisit just a couple of those points in just a second. As I mentioned before, you've written quite a lot of books in the past, from what I gather, and I apologize that I'm not very familiar with a lot of what you've written previously, but I was just wondering if you wouldn't mind telling me a little bit about these past works. And I'm also curious if any of these past books have dealt with subjects like antinatalism or extinction as well.
Good. Amanda, none of them have. This is the first time I really started to think it through.
Amazing. Okay.
The books themselves, I started as basically a philosopher of French philosophy. People might be familiar with the name Michel Foucault, the person I wrote on most. I wrote some on the other French philosopher, Gilles Deleuze, and some other more contemporary philosophers. And I moved from there to think about life issues. So I wrote several books for the University of Chicago Press. One, A Significant Life, what meaning, how we can think of meaning in a universe that doesn't offer it in a cosmic way. I wrote a book called The Fragile Life, which was about how to think about suffering. I wrote a book called The Decent Life, which is basically a book trying to frame morality for people who aren't going to try to be like moral exemplars, right? Because a lot of moral theory, Kant, utilitarianism, and such, these are how to be the best possible person. And most of us are not going there. So, how might we frame that? So I moved from sort of French philosophy to what we would call life issues, what sometimes called in philosophy value theory. And yet, so in the back of my mind, this question of extinction started to come up. So, I wrote an article for the New York Times in 20, I think it was 2018 it came out. And it's Would Human Extinction Be a Tragedy? And Amanda, just to tell you the story, I was speculating here. I was arguing it was be possible that extinction would be both a tragedy and a good thing at the same time. And I put a lot of caveats in the article. Well, it must have been a very slow news day on the extreme right. Because about 2 hours after that article appeared, I got an email invitation to be on the Laura Ingraham show. Soon after that, I got an email invitation to be on InfoWars. And about an hour or two after that, Ben Shapiro penned an article saying Todd May said we should all kill ourselves. And after that, the hate mail started. So for 3 or 4 days, I got this hate mail, and I should tell you, Amanda, I don't know what the source of it is. These people took some time to find out where I was, find my email, and yet all of them were like, "Why don't you go extinct?" And I'm thinking, "Look, you took the time to find out where I was in my email. Could you at least come up with something better than that?" So there was some worry. My spouse was a little bit worried about it. And after 3 or 4 days, she said, "Oh, is this going to be dangerous?" And I said, "Look, this is not going to be dangerous. These are not the kind of people who can hang for long periods of time on moral speculations on the future of human existence. And sure enough, 4 or 5 days later, it went away. But the thinking about it didn't go away, and all the caveats I put didn't go away. And so, they kept turning on and off. I'd written a book or two after that, and finally I said, I'm going to sit down and sort this out for myself. And that's where the book came.
Well, listen, just first off, from the bottom of my heart, I am so sorry that you experienced any of that hatred.
Amanda,
I've been dealing with that for 14 years, being a pro-extinctionist. So I know how awful it can be. And unfortunately, yeah, the most common response to extinctionism and antinatalism is, why don't you just go kill yourself? That's, I mean, I've been asked that question about 10,000 bazillion times. Before we move on to the book, I can't help but ask, how did you come to be involved in The Good Place? And I'd love to know a little bit about what that
Oh,
experience was
sure.
like.
It was pure luck, Amanda. One of the writers was in a bookstore and he saw this little book I'd written on death, very different from anything on extinction. It was just the idea is, how do we think about the fact that each of us is going to die, right? And one thing I want to be clear on, and just as I'm sure you're clear on, is the issue of one person who's alive dying is very different from the issue of extinction. That often gets muddled
Absolutely.
in some really bad
Absolutely.
ways. In any case, the writers found that, gave it to the showrunner, Mike Schur. Mike Schur read it and he emailed me and said, I'm sure you're quite busy, but would you be open to having a conversation? I didn't know who he was, so I looked him up. And when I found out who he was, I thought, well, I'm not that damn busy. So we had a conversation.
You'll make time.
We wound up Skyping for like 2 hours, and we got along. And then I started just advising the show. I showed up before the third season, before the fourth season, in the writers' room to talk with them about philosophical issues. And then about a week before they shot the last episode, they said, "Do you want? We'll fly you out for a cameo if you like." And so I did. I mean, you probably haven't seen this, but I did.
No, I haven't.
The very last episode is a. I have like a 3-line cameo.
Oh, that's so awesome. That's so awesome. Yeah, no, it's an incredible. I really, there's quite a lot of it I still haven't seen, but I've seen quite a nice sized portion of it, and I just absolutely love it. I think it's such a incredibly important thing to bring philosophical concepts on the television. When you were working on The Good Place, I assume it, working with the writers and the production team, what in any way did the subject of, because I mean the show does deal with concepts of human extinction to some extent. I mean, like the character of the judge, played by the incredible Maya Rudolph, who I just absolutely adore. She comes to the, and I don't want to, spoiler alert, but I mean, she comes to the decision that it would be better if human life went extinct. And I wonder if some of that was your influence, and just sort of like what the reaction to those kinds of concepts might have been, amongst everybody there.
Yeah, it had it, I didn't influence that at all, right? I mean, the stuff is in the back of my mind, but that was something that came up. And I think, Amanda, part of the reason it comes up has to do with the trajectory of television shows. So you set a problem, right? Humanity is now in danger. How are we going to save humanity, right? Not an uncommon plot point. And I think that's the reason that they did it. So they didn't get deeply into any philosophical questions about, right, would extinction be a good thing? It was more the idea that you have a plot, people have to be saved, and now the four humans and the demon are going to try to come save humanity, right?
Right, that makes perfect.
Partly by bringing in Timothy Oliphant for the judge to look at.
Right, exactly. So let's for sure move on to the subject of the book itself. I just want to inform our audience, the book, Should We Go Extinct? A Philosophical Dilemma for Our Unbearable Times, is not out yet. So I have not had the great pleasure of reading it. However, I do very much look forward to doing so, and I want to mention to our audience that it is available now for pre-order. I pre-ordered it on Amazon, though you'll have to let us know if there's better places to do that, perhaps. And it's expected to be released on August 6th, so please, I highly recommend everybody go and pre-order it now. Without having read the book at all, you've gone through a little bit of this already, but I'm just Yeah, I'm pretty much in the dark about what all it might include. So I was curious if you could just sort of give us, an overview of everything that the book touches on.
Sure, I mean, and I appreciate your asking. There's an introduction, and then there are three substantive parts. So in the first part, I asked the question, what did humanity contribute? What's so good about us? The second part, I said, okay, what's the damage? Why is this even a question about whether we should continue? And the third part, I talk about why we can do things or how we can do things and what the complications are in making our existence more justifiable. So let me just go back a little bit then. Those are the three parts. So in the first part, I focus on three things. One is a utilitarian idea. Humans bring happiness, and in fact, happiness is a good thing. It's a good thing for us to be here in the sense that we bring happiness. And by that, I don't mean we bring happiness to one another, right? For the utilitarian, all happiness is good. So the fact that we are happy, the fact that our lives are happy, is a contribution to the world, right? And there, I talk a bit about David Benatar, who I know you've interviewed before, and try to argue that I think he's mistaken on the idea that human lives are not worth living and that the happiness unhappiness outweighs happiness. That's the first part of the first part of the first part, as the Marx Brothers would say. Right. The second part has to do with the idea of particular contributions that we make in the sense of having lives that are uniquely valuable because of things that we do. So, for instance, there is a philosopher, Sarah Buss, who wrote an article called The Value of Humanity. And she argues that there are things like art and science and truth that are valuable in themselves, right? They are intrinsically valuable, but they need someone to be able to appreciate them. So one of the value of human beings is that we are capable of appreciating things that are themselves valuable. And if we went away, no longer would these things that ought to be appreciated be appreciated. There's another aspect to this appreciation as well, which is another philosopher from University of Pittsburgh, a woman named Nandi Tunison, said, look, human beings have this interesting ability in that we can be good for ourselves in the sense that we can create, think about and create lives. And now other beings can do this, but our reflective ability gives us a capacity for creation and self-creation that would be a real loss if we weren't in the world. So those seem to be good reasons for us to stick around. The third one goes to an article that you actually possibly are familiar with, Amanda. The philosopher Samuel Scheffler
Sure.
wrote a book, Death in the Afterlife, right? And he said, if we went extinct, he posits a children of men scenario, right? That would withdraw some of the meaning from our lives, the currently living meaning from the lives of people who are currently living, because a lot of what we do hinges on the idea that there will be future people who will appreciate it, either from cancer researchers to writers to people who open a business and are hoping that that business will continue. So that Scheffler says it would sap some, not all, but some of the meaningfulness of our lives if we knew there weren't going to be any further generations. So all of those are three types of reasons for us to continue, right? Right. The reasons for us not to continue, well, we turn to happiness, right? There is the issue of the unhappiness that we cause. I use factory farming as a particularly egregious form of unhappiness. I run the numbers of how many chickens we eat and pigs and such, and say that even in if you look outside the US, meat eating in China is going up, is going astronomically. There are in fact pig towers now in China to hold the meat. Chicken consumption in India is rising astronomically. So There's a lot of pain that we cause that would have to be balanced over and against the happiness that we bring to the world, right? So that's relative to the first part, right? Relative to the second part, what we bring to the world, our creativity, our appreciation of art. I pose an example for people to think about. Like, suppose, Amanda, suppose you're in a museum and the museum catches fire. Now, and you can save the art or you can save the people. Right. Which do you do? Almost everybody's going to say you save the people. You let the art go. The art isn't as important as the people. Right. Now, if we extend this out, and in the book I bring this out at some length, but how many animals would have to be there, right? In which to which you say, okay, we'll save the art and let the animals go. Okay, right. So in that case, right. It would seem that you're still some obligation to save the animals. I mean, there may people argue, okay, well, look, if there were like 10 chickens, we could let them go for the art. But this is some number of animals that you're going to say, yeah, we should start thinking about saving the animals. And given the consumption of animals that human beings engage in, right, that would seem to be a case for saving the animals rather than saving the art that's to be appreciated. So I pushed that idea from the museum to say all of Shakespeare, or in my case, the real painful part, all of Tom Waits we have to sacrifice. But what we can see is that at some number of animal sacrifice, it's going to be different for different people. At some number of animal sacrifice, it's going to be hard to say we should save, say, Shakespeare, right? If we're really thinking about, right, what's happening to these animals, right? Then the third case was that's the Scheffler issue, right? So with the Scheffler issue, I agree, Scheffler's right. It's surely right to say some of the meaningfulness of our lives would be sapped if we didn't have any future generations to look forward to. However, not all of the meaningfulness of our lives would be sapped. Some of it would be sapped. So what you have to ask yourself is the amount of pain that we bring to other animals, the suffering that we create, the ending of species, right? Is that overbalanced by the degree of meaningfulness that we would lose if there were no further generations? So the balance isn't between human meaningfulness and the losses we create. It's between the addition of human meaningfulness that comes from knowing that there are further generations over and against the suffering that we cause. Right? So that's the second part. Third part, I talk about a number of different things that we might do to help make ourselves more justifiable, and then some of the complications. So I go through, I think, six of them, but let me do one or two just for example. Right? So one of them, of course, is going to be around food. That there are debates about whether it's okay to take a humanely raised animal and kill it for food, right? So on the one side, you have people who say it's okay to do that, and the reason it's okay to do that, they say, is that this is an animal who's had a good life and would not have had a good life had you not raised it for food, right? Then on the other side, people say, yeah. But if you bring an animal into the world, you have an obligation to preserve its life. And there's the debate about that. All right. But even if we say that it's okay to kill a humanely raised animal, right, what we're forced to say is the vast majority of animals that are raised for food have horrible lives. And we should do something about that, right? If you can afford to stay away from animals' lives that are inhumanely raised, it's a moral mark against you and against me as well if I don't do that. But here's the complication, that there are people in food deserts who can't afford to buy the kinds of food from either humanely raised animals or good vegetarian food. And It's not their fault. They didn't ask to be put in these food deserts. So if we're going to push against factory farmed animals, we're going at the same time to have to push against poverty, to push against marginalization, right? Because we can't ask these people, right, simply not to eat or to pony up more money that they can afford. So the change in meat eating, for instance, is not simply a change in what a bunch of individuals will do. It has to be a social change that affects the society as well, right? So there's that, right? A second issue I talk about is depopulation, right? So what, human population is expected to peak at about 10 billion, I think somewhere around 2080. That's a lot of folks. I mean, when I was born, right? This is going to date me. It was like 3 billion. And so we're going to, this takes resources. It plays into the climate crisis. It plays into deforestation. All of this has to change. However, the single greatest force in curbing population is, and the one that, the only one that has been shown to work on any consistent basis is education of women, right? It isn't birth control devices, right? It's not, I'm not good having sex until I get married, right? It's education of women, all right? And so what this is going to involve, cultural changes, right? That will give access to women who can then have education and have the ability to have a career if, you know, if they so choose. And then they'll have kids later, which means they'll likely have fewer kids if they have kids at all. And just like with factory farm food, that the changes that have to occur in order to make us more justifiable to continue are not simply individual changes. They're going to have to be social and political changes as well.
Brilliant. Well, let me so much so many things I'd like to comment on. I'll try to be quick just to for our time. I mean, I like hearing that the book is a weighing of the options in a lot of respect. It's not necessarily taking one position or another, but it's sort of weighing where all of these things sit. And look, I've been vegan for almost a decade. A lot of antinatalists are vegan. That's their sort of brother sister movements in a large respect, or some of us feel that way, others don't. And so I'm all for, if we were to live in an antinatalist world or push towards that, also moving towards a vegan world and a world in which all women were educated. That sounds great to me. I mean, let's definitely try to move in that direction for sure. May I ask, just before I get to some of the other points, I mean, may I ask to what extent does the book deal with the subject of antinatalism?
In some sense, it's there throughout, in the sense that if extinction is a live option morally, that implies antinatalism, so it's there throughout in that sense. Aside from Benatar, I don't deal with any particular antinatalist thinkers. Benatar, I think, is one of the most prominent anyway. And so what my concern is to think through the issue, and in thinking through the issue to see how we might weigh one side or the other. If it were the case that the weight fell down on extinction, then it would seem that the next step is an antinatalist. What I hope what's clear, Amanda, from what I've said so far, is that this is a very complex weighing. That it,
Absolutely. Yeah.
yeah, it's this is not something that, and the reason I didn't come down on it was because I said, look, the fact that we are might reasonably consider this at all should be disturbing. And because that should be disturbing, the proposals that I make in the last chapter are proposals we should take seriously.
Right.
And some people ask, well, look, the proposals you make in the last chapter are good on their own. Why do we need all the other stuff? And my answer is, they are good on their own, of course. But if the moral stakes are as high as I'm arguing that they are, right? That really gives us a strong motivation to start taking these more seriously. I mean, if the point, if the argument is, if you don't do these things, maybe you shouldn't even be here, that should give some motivation for doing these things.
I think there's a lot of things we can do to fix the reality that we live in. I mean, there's a lot of suffering that we don't have to be wasting, and we're wasting it constantly. And I hope we do those things. But I think part of the argument that antinatalism is making, I mean, and certainly the argument for antinatalism that's very close to my heart, is that it was sort of never a good time for life to be here, that it's never been a safe environment for sentience to wake up in. And I do think this is not just about human life. It is a sentient issue. And so I wonder what you think about that. That basically, I mean, should we ever been here in the first place? Was there ever a good time for life to have begun on this planet?
Good. So, Amanda, we can take this in either of at least two ways, right? One is it bad for us to have been here, or for sentient life to have been here because of the suffering it causes? And alternatively, we can ask, is it bad for sentient life to have been here because of the suffering it undergoes, right? And those are two distinct questions, right? In the first case, I think that it's surely the case that some, I gotta be very careful how we put this, some sentient life causes suffering to other sentient life. But there all are aspects, even among prey, that make their lives, to one extent or another, worth living. Now, read carefully here. That, for instance, right, there's good evidence that a lot of non-human animals engage in loving relationships, that when they're young, they play. And that these add elements to their lives. Now, if you ask me, how does that weigh versus what suffering they might do, they might undergo? My answer is, I don't know. I'm not, I can't get into the head of a deer, right? So I can't really say. I mean, I know that animals that are facing death from a predator struggle to survive. That doesn't necessarily mean that their lives go better. That could be just an instinct that they have. That itself is not an argument, right? And in fact, right, we know, for instance, that in factory farms, that farm animals that are about to be sacrificed, even if they have had horrible lives, still struggle to survive. So I don't think you can use the evidence of struggling to survive as an argument that their lives are more happy than unhappy, or more worthwhile than not worthwhile. I just think that there's a very tough balance to get to in terms of the suffering that animals cause one another. Now, as far as the suffering well, that's also the animals undergoing themselves. If I switch to humans, right, this is where I think for most human lives, I don't think people regret being born. They feel their lives are worthwhile and meaningful. Now, I want to be careful here again about the terms I'm using. The term happiness is tricky because it seems as though from our utilitarian heritage, you can weigh happiness one way or another. But to reduce the question of the worthwhileness of, say, a human life to happiness, I think is to reduce it to something that's too narrow and too reductionist. So one of the books I wrote is called A Significant Life. And I talk about lives that are meaningful in different ways from being happy. And I think people can find lives that are not terribly happy, but still worthwhile in other ways for the people who live them. And in that sense, I think, at least for humans, which is where I can do most of my relating, that I think for most folks, they consider their having lived to be something that is worthwhile to them. And if that's the case, then I'm not well positioned to say, yeah, but you're wrong about that. Now I know Benatar has arguments of, he says, yeah, but that's the it's the Pollyanna principle and it's adaptive preferences and things like that. And my view is, well, my view about adaptive preferences is that it comes from a very different context with Amartya Sen and studies he's done, particularly of women in India who are impoverished. And I'm not sure that notion of adaptive preferences fits the question that he's asking as well. As far as the Pollyanna principle goes, I have a, my orientation is to trust people's evaluation of their lives in terms of happiness and worthwhileness, unless I have a good reason not to. And so, in that sense, I think if I'm looking, I would say horizontally, as it were, at my fellow humans, I think that our existing for our own sake as sentient beings is probably for most of us better than not having existed. Or better, I'm going to be careful. It is good for us. The reason I just hedged right there is I can't say that my existing is better than my not existing, because had I not existing, there would be no me to have been worse than, right? So it's a good that I come to exist. And so I'm not ready to embrace the argument that either that it's bad for it's bad for others that sentient life came about, or that it's bad for the sentient life that came about. Now, one more element here, because there is a complication that I talk about a bit in the book, which are reproductive strategies, right? So different animals have different reproductive strategies, right? There are case strategies of reproduction in which you have very few offspring and you take care of them a lot, right? Then there are our strategies of reproduction. You have a you create a whole lot of offspring and hope a few of them make it. And the our strategies do have a lot of suffering involved, because you have a lot of sentient beings being born, and those sentient beings, a good number of those sentient beings aren't going to make it. And that adds complication to the question of sentient life, at least as far as sentient life in terms of our strategies, not sentient life in terms of case strategies. That was a mouthful, wasn't
No, it's okay. No,
it?
I my mind is going a million miles an hour. So much you said there. I mean, on the subject of creating happiness, creating meaning, I mean, look, I do think that it's extraordinarily important and that we should always defer to what people say about their experiences of their own lives, for sure. But if we do that, then we certainly have to take into account that there are plenty of people who would say, hey, like, nobody asked me my permission. Huge risks were taken with my sentient welfare for the sake of what, two people having trying to find their meaning and their happiness at my expense. And so that sort of puts a kibosh a little bit on my ability to look at starting problems just for the sake of fixing them as a good thing. You know what I mean? And it just seems like it all comes at far too high a cost. You know, all that meaning is great, and I hope that every living being is able to find it. But the expectation that that's somehow a game that the next living, possibly living being is going to find acceptable, I think is not something I really feel the right to impose. That that's an
Yeah.
imposition on those future lives.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. It's now we're talking about the second point, not the effect that sentient lives have on other sentient lives, but the meaningfulness or worthwhileness of the sentient life itself, right? But well, I'm perfectly willing to grant that there are people who feel as though it would have been better. That it was bad for them to come into existence, right? And unsurprisingly, the person I met who most vocally articulate this was in a refugee camp in Gaza many years ago, right? But in my experience in talking to people, right, and That's anecdotal to be sure, right? People seem to have lives that are where the good balances over the bad. Now, if we going to bring a life into the world, we don't know whether that life is going to be good for the person, whether that life is going to be bad for the person. We can't be sure. But if it would be a good thing, if the life were good as opposed to bad, if the good outweighed the bad, if that would be a good thing, and if the percentages are that people have good lives, more people have lives where the good outweighs the bad, then I think what you're betting on bringing a person into the world that's going to have a life where the good outweighs the bad. And that seems like you might be doing something good for that person.
I see what you're saying. To me, that sounds like risk. That's just a very unnecessary risk taking, you know, and meaning that comes from forcing someone else to have to eat a meal that makes them sick, just feels like ill-gotten goods. And I guess that's where most antinatalists sort of would think about what you're saying. On our, you
Oh,
know, we go ahead.
but a good vegan meal. I mean, bringing something to the world is going to have like there's a vegan restaurant in Asheville called Plant, right? And Amanda, you go to Plant, right, and have a meal at Plant, you might rethink your whole position.
Oh, maybe I'm an antinatalist in a part of the world that can't afford that vegan meal, right? As you were pointing out earlier. So I don't know. So we will eventually go extinct at some point, even if we do nothing. It pretty much is assured. At some point, the heat death of the universe or something of that nature will take us out. Do you
Sure.
think we ought to do something, anything, to protect ourselves from that eventuality? Do you think it'd be right for us to plan? Like, because one of the questions you ask, at least in the synopsis, is if we should go extinct, like, should we do it sooner rather than later?
Definitely.
So should one of the great, you know, projects of the human race be planning a kinder extinction than what could end up being a very horrific natural one?
That's a good question, Amanda. I've never been asked that before. I think the answer would be yes, we should plan, or there should, put it aside, there should be planning, but not necessarily right away, because it's not going to happen right away. Now, this, of course, this is distinct from the moral question of whether we should continue at all, right? I mean, you're saying, look, assuming we should continue, and assuming that there's going to be an end to the possibility of human life continuing, right? Should something be done to get to make that landing softer, and I think the answer is yes. It's also in miniature a question that we're facing now because of the climate crisis. That it's possible that humans will make life unbearable for other humans, and we won't have to wait for the expansion of the sun. And if that's the case, then the live question for humans is good. Should we plan for the fact that it will become unbearable for people to be alive? And Amanda, this is, as you know, this is the question that young people are asking, right? They're asking it now. And I think that's a live question. That's distinct from the question I'm asking, which is about the effects on non-human life. But I think it is a live question, and one that is unfortunately also class and race and gender-based, because the people who can afford to have kids and shelter them, right, are generally in a certain class, generally. In a certain race, right? And in some cases, right, are going to be male privileged.
I mean, there are, as I'm sure you know, there are many types of antinatalism, many types of antinatalists with different motivations. So another type of antinatalism that exists is something called anti-AI natalism, and it's concerned around the development of machine sentience. So there may be no real possibility of that happening. I don't know. However, were it to happen, the scope of suffering here on this planet just about be, you know, becomes really ridiculously insidious. So if that were to happen, does that or does that not influence your either pro or against stance on extinction?
Yeah, this you've asked that question of a person who doesn't even go on social media,
Okay.
who needs help turning on off his television.
Fair
So,
enough, fair enough.
it's I mean, I know it's a topic of discussion, and there are philosophers now who are starting to be philosophers of AI, to think about these
Yes.
moral questions. I just don't know what to do about it. Or as a philosopher, I don't know what to think about it. There are talk about threats. So if we assume that there's going to be a real threat from AI, the question is, what's that threat likely to look like? What kinds of suffering is it likely to cause? What kinds of resistances, if any, can be made against that? I think to sort that question out in terms of whether we should continue is going to require more detail to see what's the picture or potential picture looking like.
I would agree with you there. Yeah, thank you for that answer. And that's absolutely fair enough. Some antinatalism is anthropocentric. It deals with only the procreation extinction of human lives, and some antinatalism is sentiocentric. I'm a sentiocentric antinatalist. It also concerns itself with the procreation extinction of animal life, so that can influence things like dietary habits. Most sentiocentric antinatalists are vegan for,
Sure.
the end of factory farming, as we talked about earlier. So we've already spoken a little bit about that divide, and your thoughts on that. But just to ask the question again, I mean, would you say that sort of most of the suffering on planet Earth is in nature? And what would you say to the idea that, like, how does our eventual extinction influence our responsibility or non-responsibility to the rest of sentient life? Like, if we go extinct, do we have a duty to also cause their extinction as well? And if not, how can we leave them behind? I mean, isn't it a little bit like leaving the children behind at the concentration camp? So, like, for the sentiocentric antinatalist, the real tragedy of human extinction is not what will be lost, the loss of our art. I mean, that's all very sad. And as a pro-extinctionist, you do sort of live part of your life in mourning. I do concede to that. But it's this idea that our greatest ethical failure would be to leave sentience, the rest of sentience, behind here to suffer. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, there's a couple places I want to take this. Sorry. Let me first take the question straightforwardly, just as you asked it. To say we have a responsibility if we were to go extinct, to have other sentient life go extinct, presupposes that we know the answer to what sentient life would look like without us. And I don't have a beat on that, right? One of the things that distinguishes the suffering we inflict from the suffering that other non-human animals inflict is that we know what we're doing. And because we know what we're doing, we, I think, have a particular responsibility to quit doing it. And so the moral case around human extinction, as opposed to extinguishing other sentient animals, is one that is not simply reducible to a question of how much happiness would there be one way or the other, but also a question of responsibility that attends to, if you know what you're doing, you have a greater responsibility to stop doing it if it causes harm, right? Now, I want to veer off that question for and just point out there's another position on the table, not mine, but one that I've seen. The philosopher Jeff McMahon has put it out. I think Martha Nussbaum has something like very close to this view, which is that our response we might have a responsibility to somehow get rid of predators that cause suffering, so that animals that don't that aren't that are prey can have better lives. Now, the reason I find that I'm puzzled about a few things, right? One is that seems to bring the possibility of even greater suffering for some prey through overpopulation and stuff, right? But I mention that just because that's a position that I've seen appear a couple places from some prominent philosophers. I say it's not mine, but That would be a position, not that we should go extinct, but that we should make predators extinct.
Yeah, no, I hear that position all the time. It is not my own either. I don't hold that
I
position
just
either.
I just think, Amanda, that it's much more likely, or better, that we have no idea what this is going to do. And there are certain balances that nature has. Ecosystems aren't stable. They're always dynamic and changing. But there are certain kinds of temporal balances that I'm not sure that we should be fooling with, because of the because of what might be pot even possibly foreseeable futures that might be worse than the thing you're trying to cure.
Thank you so much for that, Todd. So I know this is a little silly of me to ask, just considering that the new book is about to come out. But what are you working on now, if I may ask? And how can our, where can people find you on the internet, and how can our audience best support what you do?
Okay, well, thanks for asking. So right now, the thing that I'm working on is nothing. And the reason I'm working on nothing is that the book is coming out with Crown Publishing. So all my other books have come out with University Presses. And this is my first book with a trade press. Now, I advised Mike Schur on his book, How to Be Perfect, which was with a trade press. But after your book gets accepted and put into process, there's a lot of work to do with the trade press, right? I mean, I met with the marketing committee a couple of days ago, and there's right, this is good. This is going to be work, right? So I'm not thinking about the next thing I'm going to write. I'm thinking about how am I going to help these people market this book, which they're kind
Right.
enough to put a lot of work into. So that's so at this point, nothing. And it is often the case, Amanda, for me that I'll just be mulling something, and think, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh yeah, that I'm getting to write that, and that hasn't happened yet. Although I'm m mulling, five or ten things at once. But the way to find me is I do have, I'm not on social media, but I do have a website, which is, I think it's Todd May Philosopher. .com. Right? I should tell you, to maybe as we're near closing, a story of how I went off social media. Because
Yeah, sure.
I was on Facebook. That was the only media. And I was on Facebook because I was organizing. And I thought this will be a good tool for organizing. And it turned out, in my case, not in some cases it is, in my case it wasn't. And the most likes that I ever got, and this is what actually sent me off social media, was the post I had with the most likes I'd ever gotten. I was driving around Clemson, and it was trafficy, and there was terrible construction going up. And I got home, and I was just frustrated. And you know what people will, they'll get on Facebook and just air their. So my frustration came out in one sentence. And the sentence was, as I was sitting in traffic, watching these meretricious buildings go up around Clemson, I thought to myself that Clemson had moved from pre-cool to post-cool without ever passing through cool. And
Okay.
that just got so many likes. And I thought, oh, that's what social media is about. And that's what I quit.
You quit while you're ahead, though. You quit on a good point. So that's fine. Well, I mean, best of luck with the promotion of the book. I absolutely can't wait to read it. So, Todd, it's been a true pleasure to speak with you today. I really can't wait to read the book. If I may also say so, I hope to see a triumphant return to your influence over television programs in the future as well. So, thank you so much for being my guest today on the Exploring Entitled podcast. It's
Well,
been a lot of fun.
thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Pleasure's all mine.
Great questions. I really enjoyed the conversation.
I enjoyed the conversation immensely. Thank you so much, Todd. Take good care.
Take care.
Hey everybody, it's Amanda. Are you looking for an excellent way of making academic antinatalist works more available across the globe? I know I am. And so I'm delighted to announce that the wonderful and award-winning Polish publishing house,
Towarzystwo Naukowe imienia Stanisława Andreskiego,
which over the last 2 years has produced some exceptionally beautiful Polish editions of both original works like
Antynatalizm
by
Mikołaj Starzyński
as well as classic academic antinatalist works like David Benatar's Better Never to Have Been, has now opened an online shop featuring the magnificent antinatalist Ouroboros designed by
Michał Dziadkowiec.
The logo is fully customizable and available on a wide variety of products. Proceeds from all sales at the shop go directly towards the translation, production, and publication of more Polish editions by
Towarzystwo Naukowe imienia Stanisława Andreskiego.
What a perfect way for the antinatalist community to help assist an amazing company doing such important work, making more antinatalist academic works more widely available. Link below!
Towarzystwo Naukowe imienia Stanisława Andreskiego.
Hey everybody, it's Amanda. How's it going? Just a quick video. I do plan on putting up a far more exciting and thrilling commercial for this thrilling and exciting announcement very, very soon. But for the time being, I just wanted to let everybody know that the wonderful Matti Heider and I plan to have a absolutely brilliant launch event on May 15th for the celebration of our newly released book, Antinatalism, Extinction, and the End of Procreative Self-Corruption, now available from Cambridge University Press in the Elements series. As some of you, I hope, already know, you can go read the book for free right this instant by following the links below. Paperback editions are also now available, as well as hardback editions, should you choose to. But absolutely no need. You can read it for free right this second, like I said. We absolutely cannot wait for the launch event. So many exciting plans. We have guests, we have lectures, we have art, we have music. We're going to have a giveaway contest of copies of the book. So keep an eye out for more information about the launch event coming extremely soon. Once again, the date of the event is May 15th. It will be hosted on the Exploring Antinatalism YouTube channel. And yeah, that's basically all I'm going to say about it just for now. Get excited. And thank you tremendously to anybody and everybody who has, you know, even glanced at the new book. If anybody out there has any quotes about the book, just some brief little thoughts that they'd like to share with me, if you could send those to me, either by leaving a comment below, that would be great. You can also email me at exploringantinatalism@gmail.com. We'd love to just like include some little quotes about the book from whoever might wish to submit some in the launch event. So if you'd like to be a part of it, we'd love to have you be a part of it. So more news coming soon. Once again, May 15th, big launch event about the book, Antinatalism, Extinction, and the End of Procreative Self-Corruption. Thank you so much to everybody. Hope you enjoyed the episode. More news soon. All the best, and bye for now.
Hi, my name is Nimrod, and about 10 months ago, I decided that I want to try and initiate grassroots antinatalism activism in Israel, because this is where I was forced to be born. The activism is going better than I expected, so I thought that if it's working in a place like Israel, it sure can and should work around Europe. And besides, why should only people in Israel hear my nagging about reproduction?
כשאנחנו מולידים מישהו, כשאנחנו עושים ילד, מה שאנשים קוראים, אין לנו שום דרך לשלוט בזה שהחיים שלו יהיו טובים, ושהוא ימצא את החיים שלו ראויים כשהוא יהיה גדול, או דברים רואים יכולים לקרות בכל רגע נתון. החלטה הכי קריטית בחיים של מישהו, לא הוא קיבל. No, but it's not about balance, it's about suffering. Why should anyone suffer? את יכולה לחוות הורות בלי ליצור בן אדם חדש, לאמץ, שזה פתרון מדהים בעיניי, מאוד יפה מוסרית. I'm not playing God. People who procreate play God, they create new life. I don't create new life. I'm standing here with signs. People are creating new life, and they are creating a new victimizer, someone who would call suffering to others. 10 אנשים נולדים, 9 היו מושרים, 1 היו אומלל, אבל כל העשרה לא יסבלו מזה שהם לא יהיו קיימים. כי הם לא קיימים. יפה. אז בשביל האחד הזה שיהיה אומלל, לא שווה שהתשעה יהיו קיימים.
Therefore, from the 15th of April and until the end of May, I will be going around Europe to talk to people about reproduction, spreading the word about antinatalism. Madrid, Barcelona, Paris, Brussels, Vienna, Prague, Berlin, Copenhagen, Stockholm, Budapest, Rome. And all in all, I will be visiting more than 30 cities in 45 days, starting from the 15th of April until the end of May. The goal of this journey is to try and initiate some antinatalism grassroots activism in Europe. So I really hope that as many antinatalists as possible would join me to these outreach events. If you are passionate about antinatalism and I'm coming to your city, please join me. Together, we'll spread the word and normalize antinatalism. Hi, my name is Nimrod, and I'm going to Europe to make it antinatalist. Well, probably not, but I am going to Europe, and I am going to talk to people about antinatalism. They will decide, hopefully for the best.
Yeah, sorry about that. Hi, everyone. About 10 months ago, I started doing street antinatalism activism in an attempt to establish an antinatalist movement in Israel. I had many concerns for the obvious reasons when it comes to such a topic, and also due to the fact that Israel is not the ideal place, not the place I would choose to start if I could choose. But here is where I was unfortunate enough to be born in, and the familiarity with the culture and society and the fact that Hebrew is my native language made me decide to start here anyway. However, to my surprise, it's going better than I thought. And that is despite that, you, as you probably know, it was very complicated to do any kind of activism in Israel in the past year.
A peace protest to cease fire in Israel. It's a normal evening in Israel in more than a year now. Yeah, bring down the government.
Yeah, I know. Bringing down the government won't solve problems. Only anti-natalism will. But we still really need to bring down the government here.
This experience made me believe and hope that if in a place like Israel there is room for street activism on such an issue, even though it's not the ideal place to spread messages about reproduction, there's certainly potential for anti-natalism activism in many areas of Europe. That's why I decided to go on a journey to try and promote antinatalism activism throughout Europe. The journey will start on the 15th of April and will include more than 30 cities in 45 days. The goal of this journey is to try and initiate grassroots activism in Europe. So obviously the best thing I'm hoping for is that people would simply join me to the outreach events. This is literally the whole point of the journey, to try and help initiating some street activism, people spreading antinatalism all across the continent on a regular basis. If you want to help, but you are embarrassed or feel uneasy to speak with people about such an issue on the street in an outreach event, my advice is the same advice that I gave to people in Israel who were interested in joining me to the outreach events. And that is to come along, to kind of stand aside, at least at first, to listen and try to figure out how you feel about talking to people about such an issue on the street. Everyone who have joined me in the outreach events in Israel at some point felt comfortable enough to talk to people, and at some point after starting to talk to people, they felt it came quite natural to them. So there is no reason why this won't be your case as well. So please try it. Please come and join me. And you can really help even if you really don't want to talk to people, which I get. For example, by filming some of the conversations. I'm planning to take a tripod and a remote control to operate the phone so I can film some of the conversations once they are starting. But obviously there is no substitute for someone standing and filming with a camera or a phone some of the conversations. I'm sure that we'll get much better filming of the conversations if someone will do it. That would be much more efficient. And it can also be a much more efficient way for you to kind of test if you want to talk to people about procreation on the street in an outreach event, by starting behind the camera and trying to figure out if you want to stand, so to speak, in front of the camera. So another reason to come to the outreach events. Another excellent way for locals to help, as those who know the cities the best, even without coming to the outreach events themselves, is directing me to the best locations you think this kind of activity could be performed. My intuition goes for university campuses in the mornings and afternoons, and squares and entertainment areas where people hang out in the evenings. But tips from locals would be the best, because you know your cities and I don't. So please feel free to contact me or comment to this video. That will be very helpful. Another way to help, if you can, is support. So far, the expenses of my activities in Israel have been quite low. It mostly required some office equipment, such as brushes and paints and markers and stuff like that to make the signs, and some price of travel to move to the location of the events. But the case of the journey is very, very different, obviously. It's a 45 days journey, which includes more than 30 cities. So despite that, I will be sleeping in the cheapest hotels I could find, and that my bar is very low in terms of daily expenses, and food and stuff like that, and that I will be traveling by bus and by buses and trains only. Still, the expenses are very, very high. So in the case of the journey, I do have to ask anyone who supports this cause, who supports the idea of this journey, to contribute something. So I did place a donation button in the website. So if you can, please contribute something to the cause. Speaking of support, obviously the best thing you can do if you want to help is join me to the outreach events. This is literally the whole point of the journey. But if you can't for some reason, because you don't want to be open with your worldview at this particular time, because it doesn't work out your schedule, whatever reason you have, and you still want to help, and you can't help financially, because whatever reason you have, you can still be very, very helpful if you host me for the night. Not only that this will cut expenses quite significantly, it will be very, very nice to spend an evening instead of in a hostel, with a like-minded person. So for me, it's a win-win. So I would really appreciate anyone who can just host me for a night on your couch and feed me. In the details of this video, you can find the planned journey routes. And I also put a link to a WhatsApp group dedicated to the journey, where you can make suggestions on locations, give tips on where I can find cheap vegan food, where I will be able to update on locations in real time, and of course, and most importantly, where we can schedule in any of the cities where to meet if you want to join the outreach events themselves. Well, that's it for now. Thank you for listening, and I really look forward to hearing from you, and hopefully meet you in person. Hey crew, do we have it? Just kidding. I'm all alone here.
Thank you for listening to the Exploring Antinatalism podcast. Please follow the podcast on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Exploring Antinatalism can also be heard on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Buzzsprout, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Amazon.com, and so many other platforms. You can email me at exploringantinatalism@gmail.com. Website designed by Visions Noirs. Please follow him at www.bilenoir.com and follow him on Instagram. Logo art by Life Sucks. Please subscribe to him on YouTube and check out his shop on Etsy at www.etsy.com/shop/lifesuckspublishing. Music by Mati Hairi. You can hear the whole song, Life is a Sexually Transmitted Disease with a Mortality Rate of 100%, by following the link in the description. And make sure to also read his academic paper, which inspired the song, If You Must Give Them a Gift, Then Give Them the Gift of Non-Existence, in the Cambridge Quarterly of Healthcare Ethics on cambridge.org. Links below. All the best, and bye for now.
Life is no thrill compared to Neil. Life is no thrill, it's worse than Neil. So draw the right conclusion, let there be still.